Welcome back, part two with Leah Rose Nutrition. First part was absolutely fascinating and it went on much longer than we expected, but the subject's massive and I don't think we'll get this done today either. I think it's really important that we get you back on a regular so that there's things that we can get updated from by our clients, by the people that are listening and sending their questions for you, because your knowledge is key. So let's kick off.
Okay, we're going in. I'm ready.
Down the rabbit hole of menopause and perimenopause. So okay. Perimenopause can start as early as 30, in your 30s, can't it?
So there's no set age,
okay,
for menopause. So so if I just start, in case that somebody hasn't listened to the podcast before. So I'm the one previous. So yeah. I'm a nutritionist, and I have an interest in optimal health, in sports nutrition, and also in particularly for health during menopause. And the reason I have an interest in that is because premature ovarian insufficiency, I think, is something that I experienced now. I didn't know that at the time looking back, but I really struggled with PMT and a wide variety of symptoms that got put down to PMDD.
Is this what Vicky Patterson's just recently come out to talk about, PMDD? It's been fascinating, actually.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah. It's really,
really intense.
Yes.
PMS.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and the result was, for me, on my journey, it was a hysterectomy when I was 38.
Fascinating.
So there's no, sometimes it's not helpful to try to pin an age on it. And perimenopause can vary in time from like months to years.
Yeah.
So menopause is the point in time, technically, when you've not had a period for 12 months.
Right.
And perimenopause is the period of time up to that where your hormones decline. And it's the hormones estrogen and progesterone and testosterone. And that decline can fluctuate as it declines, go up and down. And so that whole period, which can take months or years, is perimenopause, and some people sail through it and other people experience symptoms from it.
Right. I think some people do bypass symptoms but still go through it, don't they? So I know somebody in particular who said she never went through the menopause, and I was like, you did.
Yeah, menopause is when your periods stop.
Yeah, and I said, that's the thing.
Or 12 months, when they have been stopped for 12 months.
But it wasn't really talked about, was it?
No.
It's become a great
subject.
My
journey was in secret.
Yeah, this is the thing.
Totally in secret.
I had a friend, she was 37 and had a hysterectomy due to really terrible endometriosis.
Right, yeah.
And I've got endometriosis too, actually.
Okay.
So I've had a couple of operations as well to clear that too. But...
I didn't talk about it. I didn't talk about what I experienced. And I received a diagnosis of adenomyosis, which is like endometriosis,
right,
but on the inside. And so I had really, really heavy periods, passing clots of blood and feeling really unwell, and IBS type symptoms and pain, and that was just the physical side. Then there was the emotional side.
Yeah.
I didn't receive my diagnosis of adenomyosis until my womb was outside of my body on a plate. I didn't talk about it.
Oh my
God. I thought it was normal. Yeah. And so
that's
what the surgeon said. Oh.
What?
No.
I've not heard of that before.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm an endometriosis sufferer.
So my hysterectomy, the decision and the journey and the path, it was taken in an informed way with consultants and gynecologist, but I focused on the PMDD and the impact of that on my life.
Yeah.
And the physical side, I just assumed that's what periods were like.
Yeah.
Because nobody talks about
it.
Yeah.
No, and it's great now that there's a lot of information out there, but there's also a lot of bad information out there. And that's hopefully, we're going to obviously debunk some of that today. But it is such a, it's a huge subject, so we won't get through all of it today. But we're going to cover some of it. So
let's see how far we get.
Yeah.
See how far we get.
Okay, so does metabolism slow down during menopause, or can that be managed with diet and exercise?
So metabolism isn't something that that you change. Metabolism refers to the burning of energy, the using of energy. And it's a term that gets bandied about a lot in menopause. And actually what changes is in my opinion, and a lot of people's opinions, so many different things that might impact how you use energy, how much energy you take in and consume through food and drink, and how much energy you use through exercise.
So fueling yourself the best you can.
For most people, menopause does happen at a stage in life when you're going through massive changes. So your kids are getting older, there might be changes at work, you may have gone through a divorce, you might be looking after elderly parents, you're yourself usually older than before, time is different, you may have more, you may have less, your relationship with food evolves and changes over time, so how it comforts you, how it fits into your social life, these things all change. If your lifestyle changes so that actually you become more sedentary because you're not running around after smaller children, you've got more time to work so you're in one place for longer, you've got more disposable income so arguably you might be less active, more holidays or more meals out, or it could impact you in any way. I'm not saying this happens to everyone, but these kinds of changes happen to various degrees to women.
But within the period that could be
within
deemed.
the most common period of menopause, and those things impact how much energy you take in and how much energy you use.
Perfect answer. That is, you're so right. And I think we don't look outside of the box enough. We just think, oh well, it's this and that's that, I've got to put up with it. But actually there could be a lot of other
menopause happens
going on
at the same time.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that menopause causes
exactly
a change in your metabolism. I use this, this is what I say to some of my clients. Okay, so I used to, a very long time ago, when I was in my very early 20s, for a period of time I lived in Swindon. And at that time, there was some statistic that came out in the papers, and I don't know how true this is, but it said that Swindon had the highest teenage pregnancy, or one of the highest teenage pregnancy rates in Europe.
Oh my God.
That does not mean that if you're a teenager and you go to Swindon, you get pregnant.
No, it's a choice.
And that's the thing that we're talking about here, is there's a difference between causation and a correlation.
Yeah, that's great though, I think, for all the menopause sufferers out there.
It gives you a bit more control.
It does. Absolutely does. Great answer. So, leading on then, is weight gain inevitable?
No.
Agreed. Because obviously there are other things to factor in and consider.
Now, when you have those declining hormones, that can feel really horrible. Yeah. And it can impact such a massive wide variety of things. So you have estrogen receptors on every cell in your body, and that's why there's such a wide range of symptoms possible that's experienced to a really varying degree from woman to woman. And so if you are somebody who is impacted in terms of sleep and ability to exercise and aches and pains and mental health and, you know, all of these things impacting you, that's going to make weight gain perhaps more likely, depending on how all the variables add up and stack up for you. And it may make it harder to lose weight. But again, it's not a direct
result right. Good to know. That means that gives hope, I think. A lot of hope.
Yeah, I'm trying to say it is important, but it's not a foregone.
Yeah. So, I mean, I believe I'm in perimenopause. And I've lost weight within it, culpable amounts of weight within it. So I know it's doable. So sometimes when I hear that, I'm like, well, if I can, somebody that wasn't disciplined, somebody that, you know, really needed to make changes, if I can, then somebody else can. And then people make you doubt that because they, you know, oh, well, my metabolism's slower, or that.
If we're talking purely about weight loss, it's a really complex subject. And when we're talking about people who are overweight or struggling with obesity, there are situations and factors that will add up to a situation where somebody really can't. Like, it can be so difficult and so hard.
Yeah.
It's multifaceted. There are a lot of different variables in these in people's individual situations.
Right. Oh, okay. So, do soy and phytoestrogens really help with menopause symptoms, or is that just a hype?
I think that for most people, there are the most important thing is to get a variety into your diet of the things that you need, and soy can make up a healthy part of a varied diet, but it's not something that can replace a hormone that has depleted.
Okay, yeah, that's fair enough, I suppose. Does cutting out dairy help with menopause symptoms?
Well, there is no need to cut out dairy if you're not allergic to it.
Yeah.
To alleviate menopause symptoms.
Okay, and that, I think that's the same with many things.
It's the same with many things, and dairy's a big thing, isn't it, at the moment? It's getting a lot of scrutiny, but we need to be careful with menopause about. We kind of want to flip the thinking a bit to what do I need and where can I get it from, not what should I exclude and what do I need to restrict, because we need to be thinking about our bone health and our muscle health and our brain health, and there's so many nutrients in dairy products. Not all dairy products are equal, but certainly milk and yogurt over butter and cream, for example, there's a definite place for that in the diet of somebody who enjoys those things.
Okay. Are hormone balance in diets real, or is there no such thing as balance in hormones through food?
So this is actually quite a, it's actually quite a big.
Yeah, it's rubbing, I'm like rubbing head my head. Like, gonna rub those brows away in a minute.
So
we're challenging the questions today.
So are hormones. Now that's a really complex topic, and it's something I'm heavily interested in. And I follow somebody called Nikki Kie and read her books and go to her conferences, and she's absolutely brilliant. And sometimes I share bits of her content, and she's somebody you can look up. But I
Who is it?
Just Nikki Kie or Kie, K-E-A-Y. She does a lot of work on hormones and exercise and performance.
Note that down, people. Nikki Kie.
And she's a reliable, science-based, evidence-based source. Now, hormones are a fascinating topic for me, but they're not. I'm not somebody who is skilled and experienced and qualified in hormones, so it's important to say that. But obviously, I've been impacted personally by the relationship between hormones and diet and exercise. Now, you can't replace hormones with diet, but diet and exercise do impact our hormonal functioning. So they are related, but balancing them, it's a bit of a claim. It's a bit of a buzzword, but we can feel balanced. We can balance our lifestyles better with sleep, nutrition, exercise, things like smoking, alcohol consumption. So what am I trying to say? Nutrition and exercise is important for healthy hormone functioning.
Yeah.
But balancing is not something I can say yes you can.
I mean, anything meno shoved onto something comes at cost, and this is what pisses me off to be honest. Is, you know, we're all trying our best to try and get through it, because I think women of our age and older and younger, even whatever, around the menopause situation are working more than they ever did years ago, so we're trying and having children later and so on. So I mean, I was 23 when I had my children, my first, and people aren't having them until they're sort of late 30s and 40s. I have no clue where they get the energy from, you know. Half the time I'm shattered. So you see these things with meno, and it's a bit like the supplement story, isn't it? We are sold something based on them saying we are deficient already. We don't know we're deficient, but we think we are because they're telling us, oh, you need this, so
but you are deficient technically in a hormone
in the menopause in a supplement sense, and with meno thrown onto the front of products and things saying, oh, can you balance the diet through, you know, no hormone treatment, is it, we believe it because they say that's what we should be doing.
Yeah.
It's a very, very tricky one to navigate, I think, as, you know, a person going through that stage in their life, because you just don't know which way to run.
Okay, so menopause technically is a hormone deficiency.
Yeah.
And if you think about other areas of health where you might become deficient in a hormone, for example, if you think about diabetes, what do we do when we don't produce enough insulin? We supplement it.
Yeah.
If you think about your thyroid function, what do we do when we don't produce enough of that hormone?
Yeah.
We supplement it.
Yeah.
So when we reduce our estrogen and we don't have enough, what do we do?
Supplement it.
No, we don't. We tell women to crack on and get on with it.
Well, yeah. I mean, you can go on for treatment, can't you? Such as estrogen gels and stuff like that.
So you're talking about HRT. That's the only way. That's the only way
to
address.
So you can't get it through food?
No.
No.
The only way to address a deficient hormone is with a hormone, a replacement hormone, and that's HRT. Now, it's not for everyone. It's by no means a straightforward, simple journey.
Yeah.
And I understand that.
Yeah.
So this is a very broad brush, general population. Like, let's just, this is also my personal point of view. But the HRT is fundamentally the only way of addressing the deficiency in estrogen and progesterone and testosterone.
Right.
Now, I've had no ovaries since I was age 38. Okay. So I've been in menopause from then, and I went on HRT before then. And HRT was complex. It wasn't straightforward. It was difficult. And I couldn't tolerate progesterone. That was part of what was thought to be contributing to the PMDD. So I know it's tricky. And that's where, and I got to the point where I chose, like, I need to have not have this anymore, and I'll go full on to the, like, I was on HRT, but I'll rely on the HRT. And I think it's important that people have knowledge. It's the same as with nutrition. You need knowledge to make these decisions. You need an understanding about what's happening to you during perimenopause and menopause. And I explain it to people when I'm directing them towards, go and have a conversation with your GP, or go and find a consultant who can help you with this. There are some really good private clinics, and again, that's not accessible to everyone, but unfortunately that's often a better route to go. There's a lot of free information available on the websites of some of the private clinics, so that's also a tool that you can use. But estrogen is really important. As I said, it's you have receptors in all the cells in your body, and estrogen plays a really important role in bone health.
Yep.
In heart health, in our brain health, in muscle health. It can impact our sleep. So low estrogen is associated with difficulty sleeping. And we don't think about those things. Those are things that I explain as risks. Those are risks of menopause. That doesn't mean that you're going to get heart disease or osteoporosis, but your risk with no estrogen or lower estrogen becomes higher. The likelihood increases without it. Symptoms are where we focus our attention at the moment, particularly in the media, and we talk about hot flushes and aching joints and IBS symptoms and brain fogs, and they're really important, and they're the things you experience in the moment, but they're not the same as the risks. The risks happen without you really thinking about it or realizing, if you're not aware of that, if you don't have the knowledge about it. Now, in the NICE guidelines, the guidelines that GPs use as their first port of call in this country, like, this is how we recommend that we treat something. If somebody goes to them with menopausal symptoms, the first conversation is supposed to be about HRT to establish whether or not that might be an option for that person. And personal choice is really important in that. But actually, that's where it starts. And then nutrition and exercise, also fundamentally important, but it sits with it. It's not one or the other.
Right. I was always under the impression that we could, you know, help ourselves, you know.
That's where I took you, because that's a really sad truth about our society and our culture.
It's replacement treatment, because
it's important.
Yeah,
it's important.
And once it's gone, it's not coming
back.
So for
my personal experience, and it's important to say that this doesn't mean this happens to everybody, but as part of my journey, I was able to go into a private clinic to help me with my PMD. This was a while ago, and actually these conversations about menopause weren't happening then, and I had to go to London. I couldn't crazy. Find anybody, and I looked, and I couldn't find anybody to help me here in the southwest, and I went to London. And the consultant that I saw, as part of my sort of treatment and the things he checked, is he recommended vitamin D. He said definitely keep resistance training. He also said go for a DEXA scan. In fact, he didn't. He said, do it here. I paid. So I had a DEXA scan.
What's a DEXA scan?
And a DEXA scan measures your bone density.
Right.
And my bone density was beneath the normal range. So you have your normal range of bone density, you have osteopenia, and then you have osteoporosis. And once you have osteoporosis, you have low bone density. That's what we call brittle bone disease. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's when fractures are much more likely, particularly through falls. Now, in osteopenia, that stage in between normal and osteoporosis, you can, with diet and exercise, bring yourself back up into the normal range.
Wow.
But with osteoporosis, you can't do that.
Stern.
And there's a genetic component. There's lifestyle, there's all sorts of different things that you've got to factor in when you think about what's my risk with something like bone density. And because I'd had low estrogen for a very long time, or pre, because that's thought to have contributed to the symptoms that I was having, and okay. and that you now they didn't it wasn't diagnosed, it wasn't mentioned, but it, when I look back, I think that there's a really fine line between what is PMDD and what is premature menopause.
Right. So, and, which is potentially where you were if your estrogen was low.
Yeah, and that's not to take away from how severe PMDD can be for some women. Some women do get suicidal ideation, and I didn't experience that. So yeah. It's important to say that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's a very serious
It's really
problem.
Serious. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it is an illness, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but it's difficult to know where a woman's estrogen levels sit because we have cycles. So you can't accurately measure menopause through a blood test through the cycle just by looking at estrogen alone.
Yeah.
Anyway, going back to my
story. Can I just ask, sorry to interrupt you, I don't want to stop
my
you
train
there.
Of thought.
I know, I'm sorry. You with the DEXA scan,
yeah.
Sorry, how long after your operation was that scan done to show you were in
osteopenia? Oh, that was before. Yeah.
And you were already there with the problem of...
Yeah.
My mum
is somebody who went on to HRT and then came off it cold turkey when there was all the scare, I think it was
about
breast cancer,
yeah.
and didn't go back onto it, and now has osteoporosis.
Yeah.
So I have a family history. In my late 30s when I went to, or mid 30s when I started going to this clinic in London, we don't know, like my estrogen was thought to be low. I was put onto estrogen therapy then, but we know that bone density is, you know, estrogen is important for that, and that I had lower levels. So what I'm trying to say with this story is that actually for me, the estrogen was really important in terms of the bone density and my future health, and my likelihood of getting osteoporosis at quite an early age was really high. But through diet and lifestyle, and I'm privileged to have been able to have found that out and to got
be
that piece of information.
Proactive enough here
but
as well.
Then I was able to be proactive and chose to be proactive. And I have DEXA scans now every couple of years, and I'm still in my normal range. But it's an important message in that actually symptoms are separate to risks. When you're thinking about HRT and thinking about making an informed choice, that's what's important to me, is if you look at all of the information or as much of it as is available to you about HRT, nutrition, exercise, and your family history and your lifestyle, then make a choice with your medical professional.
Yeah.
But please don't think off the bat that actually HRT is a last resort, because it should be right up there as one of the first things you look at.
I completely agree with that. I mean, I hear a lot, obviously, all my clients are women, mostly. Well, 99% of them are women, and I've had so many conversations about this, and a lot of them have said, oh no, there's breast cancer in my family, I wouldn't touch it. And I've said, that was a bit like the MMR jab, wasn't it? They said it created autism and other problems. So everybody stopped having their children immunised, and then there was an outburst of measles, mumps and rubella. So it takes one crazy bit of information that just goes viral and hits loads of women, and without being informed or having the accolade like you have to go and be proactive and find the knowledge and do something about it, there's a lot of women stuck that are suffering so unnecessarily for that very
with
reason.
With really big impact.
I'm going to get a DEXA scan. I am going to do that. I'm putting that, I'm writing that down right now. It's amazing. Okay, so is intermittent fasting bad, good or bad for women going through the menopause? I know we covered it in part one.
Yeah,
if anybody missed it, go back to part one.
Yeah.
We went through and down a hole with that, didn't we?
And, you know, intermittent fasting, the first question is, what are you trying to achieve? What's your goal? What's the purpose? And then the second thing then from that is, well, obviously then it depends. Like, intermittent fasting, is it going to have any miraculous benefit for menopause? Well, what do we mean? Are we talking about symptoms or risks here?
I wonder if this is a similar trying to balance the hormones question.
So there may be benefits to fasting for some people, but actually the most important thing is that you have a balanced, varied diet that meets your requirement and doesn't give you more or less than you need.
Most importantly.
Yeah.
And then throw intermittent fasting in and see if that
as
helps.
As a preference thing.
Exactly. Okay, fair enough. So do you really need to avoid caffeine and alcohol during menopause, or is it okay in moderation? Now, please, please don't ruin this for me, okay?
Tell me what to say.
It's all I've got left.
Okay, so, all right, these are two quite big subjects, aren't they?
Yes.
Okay, so caffeine. Do you need to avoid caffeine and alcohol in menopause? Gotta be careful here. Caffeine, no. Alcohol, I'm really sorry.
Oh, I'm gonna cry.
There's no science. There's none to say that alcohol is okay.
Beneficial in any way. No, agreed. I agree. I'm joking, but it's not going to stop me because I do love a glass of Prosecco.
So I talked with my clients about the value of food and the value of drink to you. And I just want to say that I'm not teetotal.
Yeah.
So
I was going to put you on the spot and say, so do you drink?
But I have reduced very significantly.
Me too.
How much compared with my younger years. So before I was on my health journey, I mean, there was always a reason. It could be a good thing or a bad reason. Like, whether my day was good or bad, it was crack open a bottle of wine. And before you knew it, like,
it's a habit.
Yeah. That's not me saying I'm a raging or was a raging alcoholic. I was. Where have we gone with this?
Every parent on the planet, I think, wouldn't it? We come home, you know, it's the only way through. At least that's what we thought. You know, it's the Bridget Jones theory, isn't it?
But actually, alcohol's really impactful in health. It impacts the quality of your sleep. It impacts how you feel the day after. It impacts the choices that you make. It impacts the food that you eat that night or that day, the day after, even the week after. You said I'm allowed to swear, but how many times do people hit the fuck it button because they've had the alcohol, right? But it has a value.
Yeah.
It has a social value. It has a value in your family.
Yeah.
And that's what I encourage people to try to think about is, what is the value of that drink? What's that bringing to you? And what's it not bringing?
I mean, that has been one of my most significant changes for this year, actually, was to really look at my alcohol intake and reduce it, because Dave and I now are at a point where we can go off on our own. Our girls are grown up. They've got their own lives.
Mm.
We go on holiday more because we're not paying for four of them.
Yeah.
And we do a lot of socials. You know, we're actually sat in my bar in the garden while we're recording. So, you know, drink has always been part of our social life. But it was getting a little bit of too much of a habit in my mind. And I'm somebody who's very conscious of their health and wellness. But it could be, I would never drink in the week at home. It was always a Friday or a Saturday. Then it became a Friday and a Saturday. And then it became a glass of red wine with roast dinner on a Sunday. So I thought, right, I can't keep doing this.
Mm.
So it really does become a habit. Yeah. And actually, in the menopause, I think my tolerance to alcohol has changed dramatically.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I can get drunk much quicker. I have the worst hangovers I've ever had in my life. I don't know if it is menopause related, and you can help me with that. The hangxiety, as we call it, or the beer fear the next day is off the scale.
But those are all symptoms of reduced estrogen as well, aren't they? The heightened anxiety and how it affects your sleep.
And that combined with drink quite toxic, hence my reasoning for wanting to slow it down considerably.
For me personally, like it was difficult. When you don't have the social network to help you, when it's expected that you're going to have a drink and people think they're helping you, you know, they're helping you with your stress or relaxing or, you know, have a drink, go on. Or because they are, like, it feels better
or
to them
when they
if
say,
you drink
you
as
mean
well.
You're not having a drink? Yeah. Oh, don't be boring.
But actually, people do get used to that. You just have to, it's hard to hang in there and work at that if your choice is to reduce your drinking or to not drink on an occasion when you're out in
I do
friends.
Think things are changing. There's so many no alcohol options now, and they're getting better and better. Dave is on the no alcohol beer and he's loving it, actually.
Yeah,
finding the benefits.
No
huge.
Alcohol wine is getting better.
Yeah. So I've not tried that because I'm not a wine drinker per se.
Right, okay.
But Gordon's gin and tonic, if anybody wants a recommendation, in the cans, pre-mixed with a hint of lime, delicious.
The non-alcohol
one. Yeah, no
there
alcohol.
Are, yeah.
It tastes just like it.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
And I work with some people who don't appreciate the amount of calories in alcohol.
That was going to be the next thing I said. Yeah. And actually, they're very low in calories. That can of G&T that I'm talking about is 23 calories.
Yeah.
And it's like 0.3 grams of fat. Might be a little bit higher in sugar, granted, but very different to a glass of Prosecco at 100 calories a pop and 9 grams of sugar or whatever that might contain. So overall, it's better for me in the menopause because I'm not getting that anxiety, I'm not getting that come down, I'm not getting that bloating and all those other symptoms that I've previously mentioned.
Yeah.
So I do think from somebody within that stage of their life, for me, it makes a massive difference. And I think you're clarifying that actually
it is
alcohol
more healthful to reduce and actually value it when you do consume it. And it, as I said before, it impacts your sleep. So it might be that actually there's more value when you have it. If you don't drink very often, if you enjoy it at lunchtime, then you've got some time for it to work its way through before you go to bed. Caffeine impacts sleep. And it stays in your system for quite a long time. And so that's why there's truth in keep your caffeine consumption to the earlier part of the day, to the morning. But actually, there's a lot of research behind caffeine as well. You need to be careful with it. We need to caveat that actually you can do yourself a lot of harm with too much, like a lot of harm with too much caffeine. So high doses of caffeine, not to be done.
As in your Red Bulls, that sort of stuff? Or are you talking your average cup of an Americano or latte?
No, higher amounts. Like if you're enjoying a couple of cups of coffee in the morning, and tea, there's not usually an issue. Some people are more sensitive than others to the impact of caffeine.
Yeah.
So you may feel it more. But if you enjoy, I mean, I really enjoy coffee. It's a big part of my life, and I love a coffee shop culture too.
Yeah,
So, in it's that horrible word, in moderation. But actually, enjoying coffee as part of your morning is fine. But switch to decaf in the afternoon.
No, I've not done that. And I should, actually, because I drink way too much caffeine throughout the day. But I'm not somebody that doesn't sleep. I do sleep.
But it's quality.
Like a dead person.
But it does impact the quality.
Really?
Yeah, of the sleep. So you may still get to sleep.
Oh.
But you might find that actually your quality of sleep... I'm not saying definitely, but...
No. But potentially could.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I thought because I slept, I was sleeping well.
The half-life is 4 to 6 hours. That means you've got half as much caffeine in your system 4 to 6 hours later after the last amount, and it's cumulative. So if you're on your third cup of coffee, like your caffeine's gone up 1, 2, 3.
Right.
And then it's going to take 4 to 6 hours until that's halved. So if you've got your
just
last...
halved.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then another 4 to 6 hours to halve.
The last one and
so
the one
it's,
after that.
I think that's right. I get confused actually by the 4 to 6, but definitely that first one is right.
You've got a lot to remember.
It's in your system.
I don't know how you do this.
It's in your system for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, I did not know that. Oh, this is interesting. Okay. So I guess the answer to that then really is, yeah, avoid it a little bit really, or be mindful.
I'm not a fan of avoid. I think caffeine, you know, caffeinated drinks, tea and coffee, as long as we're not talking silly amounts.
Yeah.
And it's in the earlier part of the day, then enjoy it if it's something that you like. Alcohol, it's very difficult for me to say. You know,
well, there's nothing good to say about alcohol. No. We know that is a toxin at the end of the day, isn't it? It's not good for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. So are supplements like collagen and magnesium actually helpful for menopause?
And again, what's the goal?
I take a collagen powder every day. And my basis of it is it's good for skin, hair, nails, and I would say that would come with in an age bracket, not necessarily a menopause bracket, I guess. Good for bones. Bone broth's massive at the moment, isn't it? And the one that I take is a bovine bone broth collagen.
It is another thing where you can spend so much money and get really heavily marketed to. And there is an article on my website at the moment and on my Substack about collagen.
Really? I'm going to look at this.
Yeah, yeah. So go there. I've gone into it in a lot more detail than I'm going to now. But the article, my article is asking... Does collagen live up to the marketing claims? And currently, with the evidence that we've got, there is some evidence to say that it might be beneficial for skin. Notice some might. May.
Yeah, you went might.
But your brain and most people's brain naturally looks for yes, no, in, out, black, white. And we need to move away from that in nutrition. So, but there's not enough to support the strong claims about it helping anything else. So bones, ligaments, joints being some miraculous thing that does something wonderful with menopause, like those things aren't a thing.
Wow.
Not in the current research that we've got. So, you know, as you've kind of said, like you can just empty your wallet with the amount of claims that are made for various
things. I'm going to swear now. Why the fuck are we allowed to be influenced
now if
and
you,
told to this
now,
level?
Now, collagen,
because I spend an absolute bomb on this stuff.
Well,
a few men.
What you should do is save that money and come for a consultation.
That's what I'm going to do. They're all going in the bin. On the way out, you can help me bin the lot.
So if you think about it, collagen's a protein. So depending on where you're at in your health and your nutrition journey, if you're somebody who doesn't have very much protein in their diet and could benefit from increasing that, then actually by supplementing collagen, you're not doing any harm.
No.
You may be bringing something in that wasn't there before.
Yeah.
But actually you could also have done that through a more balanced, varied diet.
An extra chicken breast.
But what happens is people come and they sit in front of me and they say, oh my God, it's amazing collagen. It's had this, like, it's made wonders. And it's like, has it? Has it actually? Because at the same time, you decided to make some active decisions and improve other aspects of your health and nutrition. So it's a confusing minefield. It's totally understandable why people would think...
This is what I mean. I think... I'm angry at some of them because, obviously not with you, Leah, but in general, we are sold down the bloody swanny, aren't we?
But also, to flip this, no evidence doesn't mean something doesn't work.
No, I agree.
It means there's no evidence, which means somebody like me can't say, yeah, that works.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we do have some evidence that taking collagen in varying amounts, because the studies had different amounts of the supplement in them for a long time. So some of the studies were like 90 days or more, that may improve skin elasticity.
Yeah.
But interestingly, if you think about it, where could you have more impact? Like, how much does it improve skin elasticity? It's not going to suddenly replace, like, you're not going to suddenly anti-age.
Yeah.
Could you have more impact by reducing your skin, your sun exposure? and buying a foundation, if you wear it, that has an SPF in it, or putting that on your face every day?
Mm-hmm.
Or could you have more impact by improving your overall nutritional quality?
Yeah.
So with that benefit that we found in research for collagen, it still poses the question of, but so what? Like, how much?
Yeah.
Is it worth it? Mm. What's the financial cost? What?
I think I've been... you're so right. And when I talk to you, I almost could, you know, smack myself right in the face with a wet fish sometimes, because I just think, why haven't I thought about this? You know, why haven't I thought about this, you know, logically? But we don't.
We're not. Yeah, no. It's hard. It's really hard.
This one-on-one is so important. Mm. We're going to get to that, but... Okay, so really no at the moment. There's no real evidence to show.
Well, there's some with the skin.
Yeah, but
not. But how meaningful
of,
is that?
Yeah.
Like, for one and person, it could be very meaningful, and for another, yeah, it may not. Like, it's just, all I'm saying is it's not as clear a cut as the marketing would, yeah, have you believe.
My mum's going to kill me because I've made her buy it all.
But there's no, but maybe it is beneficial. Maybe that is good for your mum and you. I'm definitely not saying it's not, but it's definitely not a box that you can put it in that says everyone should supplement collagen.
Yeah, fair enough. And it is quite a new thing, isn't it? Again,
yeah,
collagen is the new thing, yeah, out there, a bit like the bone broth.
I don't think it can do you any harm.
No.
So therefore, if it makes you feel better and feel, yeah, like you're doing something proactive and it's part of your behaviour routine that helps you commit to
it is,
a healthier
for me,
life, well, then there's a benefit.
Yeah, there is a benefit with, yeah, my supplements. Every morning,
yeah,
a ginger shot,
this is your
a collagen.
Routine. I tried that ginger shot.
Yes, you did.
My goodness.
Nearly blew.
It's nearly blew my, yeah, blew my head off.
That wakes me up. That's what I need. I sleep so well, I need something to fire me up in the morning. Okay, so can certain foods, this is interesting, really reduce hot flashes? Or is that an anecdote?
I don't think that's an easy question to answer, because on the face of it, the answer is no. Going back to our conversation about the thing that's going to stop the hot flushes is replacing the hormone. Essentially, that's the bottom line. But actually, if you make improvements to your diet, if you're somebody whose nutrition isn't on point, and your overall health and your lifestyle and your exercise and your sleep and all of those things you start to sort out and make improvements to, then you could argue that nutrition can help hot flashes, because actually it's just, you remember when we talked about the balancing and influencing hormones, but that's not, it's not replacing them.
No.
It's just helping you with your efficiency and how you feel and how you're functioning. And that is going to have a role to play. But medicinally, therapy-wise, all of those things, that's HRT.
Right. And then, so does this mean that menopause, you need to completely change your diet, or are small tweaks enough? Because... I think I know the answer. I know what you're going to
say. Go
tell
on, tell me.
Well,
tell
I think what you'd say is any improvement to your diet will improve.
Yay!
Yeah. So there you go. Yeah. So I have learned, yeah, today, and I hope everybody else has learned too, that it is about having the best possible diet that you can have. So...
Well, not even the best possible.
Yeah.
It's... I have to join everybody where they're at. So all of my clients, I meet them where they're at on their journey.
Yeah.
And what might seem like a really small change to somebody could be massively huge and impactful for someone else. So it's very difficult, first of all, to, yeah, like, what's a small tweak?
Well, quite. I mean...
And yeah, and any improvement, it's not necessarily about getting to the best point, because, again, what's that? Like, we can't really quantify that. But if we know there are gaps, if we know there are places we can improve, if we know there are things that we can bring in, add in, underpin, support, then you can definitely, you know, yes, for healthy aging,
yeah,
that's where we should go.
Right. And I agree. I think I've made so many changes in my diet, which I started 6 years ago. And my life has changed dramatically. But everything, my mindset... my motivation, my I don't procrastinate anymore. I'm motivated.
Oh my God, I need to learn about that.
I know. I've completely changed my life. And actually, having the motivation to exercise was never something in my realm whatsoever. That has become just a way of life, and I cannot live without it, because the dopamine hit that I get from that after is so important to my mental well-being. But I know now that by eating the way I eat, I feel and I look a million times better than I've done in my entire life. I think it is so massively important that how we fuel our body is what you put in is what you get out. I know you'll agree with that. But it's hard to make big changes. And I think we've got to take the word diet out of everything and make it, you know, this is life. This is how you should live.
Well,
I mean, I remember when I was eating 3 or 4 takeaways a week, I felt rotten.
I mean, there's a lot of like that word should, that's a difficult word. And what has worked for you and suits you and has had an amazing result, some people cannot do.
Yeah.
Some people want to and they can't. And some people don't want to. And those people can still and should still be supported. I've used the word should. It's a very tricky word. Mm. But health for some people looks very different to health for another person. So I think we have to be really careful here about how we talk about the things that have suited us, that have found benefit to us, and how we then try to project that onto other people without taking that person as the centre of what of our thinking. So it's on the face of it, like, I firmly believe that we are lucky in this country to be in a position where we can usually make certain choices and improvements to wherever we're at. But for anybody, there is circumstance and situation.
And that's very true. I mean, for me, I get asked a lot, how did you do it? Which was the basis of setting up Horizon with Ed, you know. He was brilliant on one side. I was a product of what is possible.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why we set up Horizon. Yeah. So that we could show people that there are ways through.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to look linear.
Yeah.
Or expected in a certain way. So I do get asked a lot, how did you do it?
Yeah.
And I didn't find any of it easy either. But
I think it stems from a value.
Something had to change for me. And this is what I say. So they said, well, what made you start? What made you make the change? I said, I don't know. I don't have that answer.
Mm.
I just know I was ready. And it doesn't matter what I say to you, you have to be ready to make changes, whatever they look like, whatever those changes are.
Exactly. So
and
for
need
some
for
people,
you.
It's like, I want to improve my diet, but I'm not going to exercise. Like, okay, let's work with that. For other people, it's I'm going to exercise like nuts and there's like nuts. I'm going to exercise like mad. There's only a few things that I'm prepared to do with my diet. Guide me through those. And it's like, okay, well, we'll start there. Other people, it's like, I'm ready. That's it. I'm all in. Let's do it. It's like, okay, let's see how far we can get with this. And some people make changes slowly. Some people make them quickly. For some people, it's a steeper learning curve than others. So some people may have had years of trying different things and a bit of background learning, and other people not. And unlearning myths and headlines and beliefs, that takes a long time. That's really difficult to do. When you then throw into that the impact of different health conditions, people of different weights, it's health and nutrition is a really complex thing. So it's really simplifying it to say, yes, we should all improve our diet and exercise more. Essentially, I guess that's where we're all trying to go, but that looks different for different people.
Yeah, I agree. It isn't easy. It's not an easy process. It's a massive life-changing experience for sure when you're there. I've got a couple more questions for you before we wrap up, but I know this is more of a nutritional question, but it's a question that a client's asked, and I maybe put it in the wrong subject, but rapeseed oils, should we avoid them completely, or is that a balanced thing?
That's a balance thing. There's no need to avoid them completely. But I'm saying that without understanding what the overall context of that person's
so
diet is.
So with rapeseed oils, again, this is something that we're scared of now, because they say when it's burnt to a certain... when it's heated, to a certain degree, then it becomes toxic. So then we're putting toxic oils into our body. And now everyone's saying, stick with your olive oils and your extra virgin olive oils. So is that a thing?
Yeah, so olive has a higher smoke point. So it hits that rancidity mark at a higher point. So therefore, it is the one that I would say, cook with olive oil.
Right.
And that's one of the nutritional challenges of... if we take fish and chips, deep fried food, often the oil is taken to a high temperature and brought down very frequently, and so the unhealthy part is not only like the calories and the fat profile of that food, but also the fact that it goes to such a high temperature and repeatedly.
That's interesting. Really interesting.
Yeah,
who knew that? Wow, I will not look at that fish fryer the same again. I don't go very often. Last question. This is one of my clients sent in this message. It says, perimenopause, losing weight. Eat less, move more, doesn't work for me anymore. Ideally, I want to lose a stone and a half. What would my ideal macros be?
So we talked about energy and calories in the previous podcast.
Yeah.
And the... It's kind of oversimplifying it a little bit, but actually the science behind weight loss and weight gain sits firmly within the law of thermodynamics, which means it's energy balance. It is calories in, calories out. But that actually simple rule sits in a really complicated situation of an individual person.
So really, they need to see you.
And macros and calories cannot be separated. So there are 4 calories per gram of proteins, 4 calories per gram of carbohydrates, and 9 calories per gram of fats. When you're calculating somebody's ideal ranges of protein, fats, and carbohydrates for their requirements,
it's
essentially what you're doing is timesing up to the calorie, the energy.
So it's very individual, isn't it?
It's very individual, and that's what I can do if people want it in a consultation, is take them through that process, help them to understand it, and also make the recommendations for protein, carbs and fats. But in making those macro recommendations, I'm also making a calorie recommendation, because they will total roughly an estimated amount. We can always only estimate it, because how can we possibly know, and we're dynamic all of the time, moving. It does become harder due to a number of things that we've touched on already. But essentially, calories and macros can't be separated.
Right. This is why it's so important to go to the right place to get the right answers, and to take out all the TikToks, take out all the socials, take out all the snippets of information that are thrown at us in generalization. And I know that there has to be a generalization, because the subject is so massive. We know that we've gone through it. But I think that's why it's so much better to remove the apps. We know about these apps that are now, you know, they're just money spilling apps that are taking money. The best place to go is to somebody with your knowledge, to you on a one-to-one basis, because nutrition is so important for you as an individual. So with that in mind, how do people get your one-to-one, and what does that look like?
Okay, so you can find me online on www.leahrosenutrition.com.
And we'll put all of this in the bios and the links in the socials so people can see that.
Thank you. I'm on socials too. You can find me LinkedIn, Instagram and Facebook at Leah Rose Nutrition. And you can email me info@leahrose.com. So you'll find out about me, a bit more about my story. All of that is online and how I work. My service is tailored to individuals and what they need and what they're looking for. So some people might come to me with sports related goals. Some might come with weight loss related goals. Some will come with a health related goal. Sometimes it's all of those things. And sometimes it's people struggling and wanting to learn more about menopause. And that's their tipping point, and they've decided they're going to look at dietary quality in that context. So I work on a one-to-one basis. I also do corporate talks, but with individuals I work on a one-to-one basis, and in that consultation it's a really detailed and in-depth analysis and exploration of your health, your situation and your dietary profile as it is now. And then what we do is we look at what we can bring in and what we need to build on for that dietary improvement to happen and to better meet your requirements of whatever they are. And I send people away with clear recommendations and next steps that match like what they need at that point in their journey. And I follow that up a few days later, as soon as I can turn it around, with a write-up, because it's a lot of information. Yeah. It's a lot to remember. Mm-hmm. And if you're working with other healthcare professionals, you might want something to refer back to, and for yourself anyway, just to look back at what we covered at that point in time. And if I'm working with someone with calorie and macro recommendations, that would be in that write-up. And then after that, it's a matter of choice. I do have an online platform that I use that connects to things like Garmin, and Apple Watch and different apps, Chronometer, MyFitnessPal, that collates the data that you're collecting if you're a data person. Yeah. So I can work with that.
I love my Apple Watch.
But that's not essential. I do, you have a choice. You can book back in to help with, I call them implementation sessions. So you can book back in to help with implementation if you want to on a one-off basis or with packages. So some people do it on like a monthly or a quarterly basis.
Yeah.
But for some people, the consultation's enough.
So I think I know so many people that would really benefit from one-to-one with you. I'm definitely booking in from a one-to-one with you. There's a lot that, you know, I thought I was quite well oiled in the industry of nutrition to a degree, not on a professional level, obviously, but I think I've gone down many rabbit holes over the last few years and I've realised what's right and what's not. But there's so much of what you've said today that I didn't know either. So I'm definitely booking for a one-to-one. What sort of cost would that be for someone?
So at the current time of recording, the consultation fee is £145.
And how long is that session?
It depends. It varies from person to person, but it's usually about an hour, maybe slightly over that, to an hour and a quarter.
Right, brilliant. So no excuse for not having enough time to be able to do it either, is there? I am so excited for people to hear this, and I still don't think that we've covered half of what we probably could. So will you come back and do another one?
Of course, yeah, I'd love
brilliant.
To.
I've
yeah,
loved definitely. It so much. I've learned so much. I hope everybody else has enjoyed it as well. And I'm booking with you and I'm getting a DEXA scan. So there you go.
Good luck on your journey. Thank I would you. Love to be a part of it.
You
Thank
are.
You.
I'm booking in. Thank you so much for your time. I know you're a busy lady and I really appreciate it. And people will really benefit
Thank
from
you
your knowledge
me.
And
Thank
information.
You.
Thank you so, so much.